Welcome back to Will I Ever Learn Chinese? I'm Jeanette Seikel. And in this fifth episode, I'm going to discuss learning grammar. And having looked at the differences between children and adults learning a language before, we may conclude that there must be something about adults already having a language system at their disposal that helps them along with learning grammar rules in a new language. So, explicit grammar teaching on the basis of the adult's first language, in a way, would make sense, because it simply teaches the adult learner about things they already understand, and thereby skipping many steps. This, I have to say, was very much my own thinking in the past. If a grammar rule is explained clearly enough, I would get it, and I would thereby avoid the huge amount of work figuring out how the language works by deducing it from the context in which it is used. However, I have come to change my mind, and here is why. Learning an explicit grammar rule doesn't necessarily mean that you'll be able to use it. Getting it is quite different from applying it. And I learned this because I saw a friend of mine go through this experience. He is a very talented linguistics researcher, and he secured a permanent teaching post abroad. He didn't know the language at the time, so he enrolled in a language class. But that left him frustrated, as he told me at great length, because he said he understood it all. It was boring. While his fellow students were struggling to learn the language, he sort of got it and then zoned out. And he soon became disillusioned and left the course. Most of the other students on the cohort went on to eventually become relatively fluent in that language, while he, on the other hand, never really reached full fluency, despite having lived in the country for many years now. While he fully understood the grammar and found the course too easy, he never actually acquired the use of the language in the same way that the other students did. So for him, grammar teaching was the wrong approach. It gave him some sort of sense of security and theoretical knowledge, but the practical application was missing. There are, of course, cases where explicit grammar teaching can help the learner along. Ultimately, the degree to which grammar is taught explicitly in a successful way depends very much on the individual learner, but also on the languages. Because languages differ in their grammatical structures, and some structures can be confusing if not taught overtly. Working out the differences from the context may take much longer. When it comes to learning to speak, there is a fine balance to be had between crucial insights into grammar and way too much detail that may actually hinder a learner starting to speak. And I remember this when I first started learning Icelandic in my late teens. I already spoke Swedish at the time, and this is a related language and has many cognates, which means words of the same origin. But Icelandic grammar is very different, and it is incredibly complex. Many of those grammatical forms have disappeared from Swedish, but they're still very much present in Icelandic, and that makes it quite a hard language to learn. These forms were quite irregular as well, so these inflections weren't just one set I had to learn, but I had to learn them for each of the verbs that I was learning. And I remember sitting in front of pages and pages of paradigms, which means lists of the verbs and the nouns in the language and their various forms in which they can appear. And I was trying to memorize these.
Ég fer, þú ferð, hann fer, við förum, þú ferð, þeir fara.
I go, you go, he goes, we go, you go, they go. Of course, knowing that the verb to go can sometimes have the form fair, fur, and far, that was very useful, and I became more alert to these forms in context. Also knowing that the verb differs in forms according to which person goes, well, this was very useful too. But learning these forms in isolation did not really help my verbal fluency of Icelandic at all. Actually, if anything, it hindered my learning. Because whenever I wanted to speak, I first had to think back to those paradigms in my head and recite them to find the suitable form. Research shows that some of these forms, especially the irregular ones, are more easily acquired in context when the language is used, rather than being learned as separate entities outright, as I had been doing with Icelandic. And when we hear the language being spoken in context, often in chunks, or so-called formulae, it becomes much easier to remember what was said. So, with this verb to go in Icelandic, the form that I eventually remember the best, despite having recited the paradigm many, many, many times, was the form að fara, the infinitive, I have to go. Ég verð að fara, I have to go. And this is a line in a song I liked, and which I learned solely in that context. So, when I was learning Portuguese, I also encountered such formulae in contextual language. And only in hindsight did I actually realize how extremely useful they were. I remember learning in my gamified learning program, Esa menina está despejando água na sua cabeça. This girl is pouring water onto her head. And this was accompanied by a picture of a small girl doing just that. And at the time I thought, I will never ever need that. Have you ever encountered a situation where a girl is pouring water onto her own head? And did you, in that situation, say out loud, the girl is pouring water onto her head? If you did, you've just proved me wrong, but I imagine very few listeners will have had the need to say this. However, this example taught me loads of other constructions that I keep relying on to this day. I learned the ongoing action, be pouring, the word for pour, and how to use it in context, such as pouring something onto something else and the correct way of saying that. But it also taught me about the possession, her head, where in Portuguese the possessive pronoun her reflects back to the girl in gender, using the feminine form sua, rather than the masculine form su. I guess this is just like in English, where we distinguish between her head and his head. But I had to learn this as I was learning a new language. I had to learn what Portuguese was doing in this situation. So I was encountering the form in this example, and this reinforced what I had been learning. And I also remember the example, perhaps because I thought at the time that it was so silly. But because the example was so strange, and I thought that I would definitely not need it, I became much more aware every time I needed little bits of this example. So the knowledge acquired using this example, I actually used on many occasions. And whenever I used this knowledge, I subconsciously thought back to the photograph of the small girl pouring water onto her head. I was actually amazed how often I was thinking about this photo and how frequently I had to use the elements in this construction, even though I never had to use the exact wording used in the program. When I went to Brazil after half a year of using my gamified learning program, and I was encountering examples like the above, my Portuguese was actually not only decent, but I could converse pretty freely. So I had a much better grasp of some grammatical constructions I had struggled with in other languages. For example, Spanish, which is very closely related to Portuguese. I had learned Spanish using various traditional approaches. And I had been learning Spanish and using Spanish for much longer. But for example, both Spanish and Portuguese have a distinction between actions in the past. In Spanish, you can say, José habló con ella. José hablaba con ella. They mean, José talked to her. However, the context in which these two expressions are used are different. José habló con ella means José talked to her once, and the action was then completed. José hablaba con ella means José used to talk to her repeatedly, but that is now over as well. So, when learning Spanish, I had learned just the rule, use hablaba in habitual past actions, use hablo for actions that occurred at a specific point in time in the past. Whenever I was speaking Spanish, however, I would often stumble over this rule. I would be thinking in my head which one would be the most appropriate, and by the time I had found it, if I ever found it, it was already too late. I'd already said something. And quite often I would say the wrong form. I would use the wrong verb form. But since I had not learned Portuguese consciously in this way at all, but rather through my gamified learning approach, I dealt with these situations very, very differently. I learned the distinction almost instinctively, and I was able to use it freely without ever thinking about any grammar rules. And because Spanish and Portuguese are so similar with respect to this grammatical structure, and actually many other places as well, I was eventually able to use my contextualized learning of Portuguese and extend it to Spanish, becoming more accurate in my use of the correct past tense form in Spanish. So, reading my grammar books and trying to memorize grammatical rules had confused me more than it helped me when learning Spanish, and it was only when I had been learning the same construction in a much more natural environment in Portuguese that I was able to use it correctly in Spanish. So far, we have seen that a little bit of grammar explanation can help, while too much grammar learning can hinder. It can confuse the learner's understanding. The learner may think they understand it, but actually not use it. In my experience, though, having no grammar input at all can be problematic too. For some languages, this seems to be the case more so than for others. And I was attending an evening class learning Arabic, but I also at the same time stumbled across a very old second-hand copy, again, a CD-ROM of my gamified learning program to learn Arabic. And since I had been learning Portuguese quite successfully with the program, I decided to buy it and give it a go. This was, I have to stress, a very old version of the program, and it was not yet very well developed. And it started by introducing incredibly complex constructions right from the beginning. And while I was already able to speak some Arabic, I felt desperately lost. I felt I needed a different approach that helped me understand some of the underlying forms first. This approach would have involved some simple explanations. Why, you might ask, is that? Well, I think it has something to do with the structure of the language, because Arabic is quite different from English in that it uses what we linguists sometimes call templatic morphology. What this difficult word means is simply that words are built up around central consonant roots. So the three consonants, K, T, B, K, T, P, in this order, means something related to writing. It can be used in different environments, either with different vowels in between, with different elements at the front or at the back, maybe even with duplicating some of the consonants. So we can say kitab, which means book, kataba, he wrote, aktub, I write, maktub, written, and so on. So this KTB is there all the time, and the overall meaning, the lexical meaning, is there underlyingly. Once a learner understands the patterns in which these forms occur, they can be used with other roots to express the same grammatical information. So we can, instead of KTB, we can take DRS, and this means study in the widest sense. Using the same rules as for kitab, we can now add vowels, we can change the word around, and thereby develop various meanings, such as adrus, I study, which is parallel with aktub, I write. So, for the learner of Arabic, having a brief explanation of this system is really useful, as it explains the patterns behind a seemingly random construction, and it thereby focuses the learner's attention. And I certainly found that I needed a quick explanation of the system first to grasp what was going on and understand the patterns behind this language. But later on, it was really the language used in context that helped me learn it better. When pondering how to best learn Chinese, I reflected on these past experiences. And when it came to Chinese grammar, well, I had read that there was very little. What does that even mean? Well, in linguistic typology, this is the study of the patterns of the languages of the world, languages are divided up into different types that sit along various scales. Some languages have a lot of complex grammar, like Icelandic, with inflections and irregular forms. And these languages are typically referred to as fusional languages in linguistic typology. Fusional languages sit on a scale, and at the other end of the scale are languages that have hardly any inflectional forms, so that have hardly any of those grammar forms I was so struggling with in Icelandic. And in these languages, words can appear on their own without further grammatical marking. These languages are called isolating languages. So the scale goes from isolating to fusional languages. And along this scale, Mandarin is pretty much at the isolating end. There are further scales. One other scale is the scale of synthesis, which indicates how much accumulated information a word or an element within a word can hold. Chinese words are typically single syllables that each have their own character in the writing system, and we'll explore that in more detail later. There is a preference in Chinese for two of these words in inverted commas to be combined in context, which leads to a lot of different combinations. Where such combinations are common, the words themselves do not hold much information, but rather one meaning maps beautifully onto one word. And thus Chinese is referred to as an analytic language, which is different from languages that are synthetic or even polysynthetic, which is at the other end of the scale. Polysynthetic languages hold a lot of information. And I have learned a few polysynthetic languages, so from personal experience I know how difficult it can be. One such language is Kalaallisut, also called West Greenlandic. In Kalaallisut, words can get very long and hold a lot of complex information to the degree that you can express whole clauses with subject, verb and object in one single word. One of the first words that I learned in Greenlandic is I will make coffee. Kaffiliusanga. It consists of various elements that we can separate by dashes. Kaffi dash, liu dash, sa dash, anga. These all hold meaning. Directly translating as coffee, make, will I. While the loanword kaffi could appear on its own, the other elements have to be attached to something else, such as coffee in this case. These elements, called suffixes, have to be attached after the root coffee. And some of these elements contain quite a lot of information, so don't just contain one element of meaning. So anger, the last element in this long word, means I future tense. Mandarin, on the other hand, has all separate words.
我要泡咖啡,
which directly translates into I will steep coffee. Note that the loanword cafe consists of two elements, and these are written in two separate characters. One does not really have to go to extremes like polysynthetic languages to see how Chinese is different. Imagine the plural in English. We can say a tree and trees. The first is referring to one entity in the singular, and the second one to various unspecific entities in the plural. The addition of a tiny suffix, this is this little s at the end of trees, indicates that tree is now in the plural. In Chinese, however, both tree and trees is shu. If one wanted to disambiguate whether one is talking about one tree or various trees, one would have to use extra words.
一棵树,
one tree.
各种树,
various trees. In this way, we could express the meaning in Chinese, but again, these are separate words, whereas English uses a mere suffix to indicate the plural. Shu in Chinese remains the same in its form, and it's only the surrounding context that indicates whether or not we're talking about one tree. Mandarin has less complexity within words when compared to languages such as Kalashlisut or even English. At the same time, concepts can be expressed through other means. In Chinese, that is by putting a range of words together to express that something is plural, for example. Would that make learning Mandarin easier? Would I be able to do it without any overt grammar instruction, learning Mandarin, as opposed to Greenlandic, where I would need some of that instruction? As I was progressing in Chinese entirely without any grammar instruction, there were a lot of times when I didn't quite understand why a construction was one way or another, or why people would say one thing rather than another. And sometimes it would take me a few weeks to figure out what was going on. Sometimes, though, I felt that I needed an explanation. Luckily, Christmas was around the corner, and I put a Chinese learner grammar on my wish list, and Father Christmas kindly produced a copy. And my grammar, in a way, arrived at an opportune moment because I started to look up select constructions that I had been puzzled about. For example, I had encountered the so-called bar construction in Chinese, and this really confused me. I assumed that it must be some kind of focus construction, putting some word in the sentence in focus, but I was not entirely sure when to use it. I tried to look at a lot of sentences to see when it would be appropriate to use, and I had a working hypothesis, but I never got to the stage where I felt that I knew what I was doing. There were various other constructions, such as the 是的 construction in the past, of certain actions in the past. And again, I had a working hypothesis, but I had no idea when it would be appropriate to use. I simply did not have enough examples in my learning program to have a big corpus to consult and find out when it would be okay to use and when it wouldn't. So in these cases, taking a shortcut, in a way, was a bit of a treat for myself. I had a look in my grammar book. And as I read the clear outlines for both constructions in the grammar and understood the circumstances under which they were used, I was very relieved. At the same time, again, I was marveling because isn't it wonderful, I thought, to learn a language where, when you're stuck, you can just go to one of the many resources that will help you out. There are so many different grammars and teaching materials and so on for Chinese. So many more than I could ever try out myself. I learned a number of other languages, such as Finnish, which I learned during my time at university. And Finnish may have fewer resources, but there are still plenty of resources to help you when you're stuck. There are other languages I've learned, though, where There was nothing like this. And when you're stuck, you're stuck. You have to figure it out yourself. For my PhD, for example, I studied a South American indigenous language called Musitén. It is spoken by a few hundred people in the Bolivian tropical foothills of the Andes and also parts of the adjoining Amazon basin. Previous visitors had compiled some very basic word lists for the language and had jotted down one or two grammar rules. And a neighboring language, very closely related language called Chimana, had some materials written by a missionary who had embarked on translating Bible portions. And eventually I got my hands on those materials and they were very useful. But they had been written predominantly to teach missionaries the basics of the language and did not always fully cover or go into detail with the intricacies of the grammar. Thus, I had actually very little to fall back on when learning Musitén. My aim for my PhD thesis was to produce a grammar of the language. So I had to figure it all out for myself and then write it out in such a way that it could be read by people who are not speakers of the language. Wow, how do you even go about that mammoth task of writing a grammar of a language? It is, in fact, not very different from the approach I took when learning Chinese. There are a range of different techniques, and the linguist can approach languages differently depending on the circumstances. So when I was working with the Musiténes, the people who speak Musitén, they all spoke Spanish already, and most of them spoke Spanish much better, actually, than they spoke Musitén, which is a very typical situation of language endangerment. I found someone who was very keen to speak to me and to help out. This man was called Juan Wasner, and he had in the past done some writing workshops. He was a keen linguist. He was trying to teach the language at school. Juan and I worked together for many years, and I learned about the structures of the language through his help and with him as we were working together. The first day we met for work, I asked him to tell me about himself in his language, and I recorded everything. He talked for quite a long time. And in what he was telling me, I heard the occasional place names or Spanish words that I knew. He said Bolivia, Santa Ana, which is a local village, Secretario de Salud, health secretary. So I had a rough idea what he was talking about, at times at least. When he was done, we replayed the entire tape and wrote it all down, eventually translating it into overall sentences. Well, at this stage, we weren't really sure whether they were actual sentences, but they were more or less those comfortable chunks you get in conversation when there is a little bit of a break. At this stage, I decided that it didn't really matter too much whether they were indeed actual sentences. I would revisit this at a time when my command of the language would be better. After doing a rough translation, I spent some time figuring out what structures there may be in the language based on the information I had gathered. And then I sat down again with Juan to translate the text word by word. At this stage, I was forming a lot of hypotheses in my head. Oh, the word order seems to be like English. Subject, verb, object. Verbs seem to be very complex and express a lot of things. This looks rather like Greenlandic. I reckon there will be a lot of suffixes for me to explore. I was gradually building up a lexicon and shaping the first shaky hypotheses about the grammar. But I needed a lot more information. I gathered that information in due course in order to test my hypotheses. But how does one, in a short space of time, get enough language data that would cover all of the language? This is indeed not necessarily easy. For writing a grammar, you don't necessarily need as much language material as you would for a dictionary. Because if you're putting together a comprehensive dictionary of the language, you would have to cover all sorts of topics. Grammar is much more underlying and, in a way, restricted. and you can gather a lot of grammar information through less data. But having said that, you will need a lot of different situations. You will need to cover very informal language and formal language, maybe even the written language, even though in this case there was barely any written language available for this particular language. But you have to try and cover all the different bases. So, to capture all those grammatical rules, getting situations that are, for example, very formal, imagine the English subjunctive. It is important that he arrive promptly. In this case, arrive is in the subjunctive. Now, this would be used in very formal situations, and it would probably not be used by many speakers. They might say it's important that he arrives on time, or he'd better be on time, or otherwise I'll get very angry. So, to get lots of different examples of the language in use in different situations, field linguists like myself try to get as many different texts as possible. And that means recording speakers of different ages and backgrounds, recording interviews, monologues, discussions, and formal speeches. In Mosse 10, I eventually also recorded songs, and I had some of the speakers who knew how to read and write out stories in their language. And then having such a diverse corpus of language data, I was eventually able to work on the grammar of the language. But just having this language data is not always enough. Sometimes, as with the Chinese example above, you need to understand the intricacies that are not always apparent in the data. But when there is no grammar book to consult, what do you do? I was quite often in the situation where I wanted to know what this ba or shida construction was, as I did with Chinese, where I eventually looked in a grammar book, but I couldn't do that for Mosse 10. Well, field linguists use a technique called elicitation, and this technique can actually also be very useful in language learning. It involves asking a speaker, usually a native speaker of the language, questions about the language in the hope to better understand those structures. So I was doing just that. I was conducting elicitation with lots of different speakers of Mosse 10 in order to figure out how some of the questions I couldn't quite get at through the texts were played out in the grammar of the language. Using elicitation can be an incredibly powerful tool, but one also has to be careful, as one can easily get skewed data. For example, when a linguistics expert asks a speaker, "Can you say blah in your language?" The speaker may say, "Yes," for two reasons. The first one, the linguist has just said blah, so you can evidently say it. And secondly, the linguist surely is an expert with a university degree and thus a high status, so she must be right. The trick is, therefore, to do elicitation in such a way that it does not trigger unintended answers, but rather teases out native speaker intuition. And this could be by asking the speaker to give an example using certain words or constructions, or to rephrase something. This process of analyzing texts, of doing elicitation, as well as speaking the language in contexts where one might pick up more or less formal expressions, it is a long one. But gradually one learns more and more about the language and its grammar. And in a way, using my gamified approach to learn Chinese was very much like my fieldwork on Mosse 10. I was presented with language data, sometimes with messy data or with data I found difficult to decipher, and I had to figure out how the language worked from there. And in doing that, I was learning the language as it was used. I was making sense of the input in my brain and then formulating the first wobbly rules of the language in my head. And I was constantly testing these rules against the language input I was seeing. Were my assumptions right, or did they need to be revised? And if you, like me, like puzzles, this process is just so satisfying, but it is also quite time intensive. And as a language learner, do we really have to write out grammar rules? Well, of course, my aim when learning Chinese was never to write a descriptive grammar of the language. Rather, I wanted to ensure that I could understand and use the grammar, making the underlying language structures conscious in my mind to then be able to use them myself. During fieldwork, my primary goal was not to speak the language fluently, even though I did learn to speak it well, but rather it was to be as certain as possible about the different grammatical constructions I was encountering, to ensure that the grammar book I was writing was the best it could possibly be. Looking at first-hand language data and conducting elicitation with speakers, I picked up the language with ease. So using my fieldwork experience, as well as a gamified language learning approach that had worked for Portuguese before, I embraced this grammarless beginning of learning Chinese because I knew that I would be able to extract grammar in context. I also knew that merely reading grammar rules would not help me to learn the language. Becoming conscious of grammar rules, figuring them out for myself, and conceptualizing them in my head would work much better. So learning Chinese felt a bit like easy fieldwork because all the language data was already there. I didn't have to go out and collect any. I could start reading and listening to simple, easy data at first without having to dive into very difficult texts straight away. And I could consult a grammar book when I felt the need, when I wasn't sure about something, and when I had a working hypothesis and wanted to check whether that was true or not. I kept progressing in this way and I kept really enjoying it. But of course, there were a few difficult words, especially when it came to the pronunciation. And there were constructions I didn't quite get in the beginning, but I trusted that I'd pick them up soon enough. I didn't really have to learn every single detail perfectly. I felt that as long as I was able to progress, I would be perfectly placed to continue with the learning. But another pitfall was waiting for me in an entirely unexpected place, and I shall be talking about this in the next episode.